All righty, it's 10:45, so I have very, 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 very strict orders to get going on time. I'm Dan Vergano. I'm a reporter at USA Today. I'm one of the Nieman Fellows, and Josh is one of my fellows, and I'm introducing him here. As you probably know, the routine is there'll be a 20-minute question period at the end, and you are asked to line up at the mic before you make your questions. This is all being reported and recorded, rather, and probably live blogged and so forth. At any rate, Josh is you know, probably the best-looking Nieman Fellow this year. I think we'd all agree. And he's also a reporter and columnist for the Dallas Morning News for that Toledo Blade. He's an award-winning education reporter, probably best known for statistical analysis of cheating in Texas high schools that has cost a lot of people their jobs and so forth. Ben, he's also been blogging for a while on crabwalk.com. First foray into the intranet was 1994, he's a very thoughtful man, and thank you all for coming and listening to him.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Dan. Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's great to have a chance to talk to you all about a topic I'm somewhat passionate about. Just by way of background, as Dan mentioned, I've been online since the early 1990s. I dug up on my hard drive the first web page I ever had in 1994, sophomore in college. Notice, you know, I'm a Cajun, so hence the title, but notice that the L, the capital L in the online, that was very in for about 5 minutes in 1994. I started reading blogs in 1997, 98, just when they were really getting started, and started my own in 1999. And my current blog, crabwalk.com, which is here, I feel bad because I took a screenshot, and it just so happened that the most recent post is a video about fighting cheeseburgers. So, of course, it's otherwise very serious discussions of meaty topic, well, not meaty, but. It's been up since 2001 or so. But, you know, I've been in the blogging world for some time, and I've given talks over the years about journalism to bloggers and blogging to journalists. But I've always kept the two pretty separate. I'm not the web guy at my newspaper, the Dallas Morning News. I'm a traditional newspaper reporter. I write stories, I write projects, I do investigations. You know, I'm not the guy who's coding dallasnews.com or doing flash presentations or anything like that. So I think that's given me a pretty good perspective to understand the strengths and the weaknesses of the form from different angles. Just a show of hands, I'm curious, how many of you are bloggers in any capacity? Okay. How many of you have a personal blog that's just your blog for your friends or whoever's interested? Okay. And how many of you blog in some professional capacity for some news organization? Jeez. All right. It'll be all of you soon enough. First, I just want to start off by talking about what I'm not going to talk about today. We can talk about some of these things in the Q&A if you're interested, but some of these issues I'm kind of tired of, quite frankly. What is a blog? You probably all know what a blog is by now. Are blogs journalism? Who cares? That's an old, tired debate. Some of them are, some of them aren't. There's your final answer. I'm not going to tell you how to set up a blog. I can tell you if you want. It takes 30 seconds, but we'll do that later if you're interested. I'm not going to tell you how to make your blog popular and, you know, get Kotke.org to link to you and Boing Boing to make you their new best friend or anything like that. I'm not going to talk about a lot of the great things about blogging that aren't directly related to narrative journalism, you know, like the interaction that you can have through a blog with your audience, which I think is a very important topic, but I'm just not going to talk about it today. What I am going to talk about is how blogging can fit together with narrative journalism, which at first may seem like a contradiction in terms. When you think of narrative journalism, you think of these 15-day Tom French series that, you know, are written very beautifully and, you know, big swaths of the Amazon get torn down in the rainforest to print these endless column images, and, you know, people work on them for months and months. And when you think about blogging, you think of something that is very quick and loose, maybe a little bit sloppy, kind of tossed off. You know, one is really about polish, and the other is about rawness. And I don't want to overgeneralize. I mean, you're all interested enough in blogging to be here, but it's been my experience that a lot of the journalists who are most interested in long-form narrative work, the people who, you know, want to write for the New Yorker and, you know, that sort of folk. I bet some of you probably fall in that category. Those are often the people who are the most skeptical about blogging and the people who often sort of view it as, you know, something for the unwashed, something for, you know, that's what the hoi polloi does. You know, I am a great literary scholar. I'm not going to be doing that. And I think that that disconnect between the narrative end of people, of journalists, and the blogging end of journalists is an unfortunate thing, because my argument today is saying that really these two sides have a lot more in common than you may think. They are, in a lot of ways, alternate methods to achieve the same sorts of ends. And most importantly, I think that both narrative journalism and blogging on the two ends of the spectrum have the potential to be subversive forces in American newsrooms. And I, for one, I don't know about you guys, but I think that we need a lot more subversive forces in our American newsrooms. When I was preparing for this talk, I wanted to, you know, I'm a very highly trained journalist, so I did what all highly trained journalists would do. I went to Wikipedia to see what narrative journalism is. And they had a number of quotes there from people. You can start to see them down here about what makes narrative narrative. And I went through there and I picked out three sort of unifying themes. First one is that narrative journalism shares characteristics with what I'm going to call natural storytelling. I'm going to come back to this, but meaning it's closer to, you know, a human conversation, you know, a story that you'd tell around a campfire, than the kind of bastardized form that newspapers have adopted over the many years, the sort of strangely voiceless, annoying, horrible newspaper form that we all, you know, came to this conference to avoid. It features developed characters, not just sources. The characters have a depth to them. They're not just experts being quoted. They are recognizable and identifiable human beings. And third, it gives the reader a sense of place and time and drama, you know, through detail and perspective and all the other things you're hearing about and all the other talks here. It allows the reader to think he or she is in the moment watching the story unfold around them. I'm hoping I can convince you today that blogging can accomplish all those goals in a very different way than the 15-part Tom French series can, but in just as legitimate way. To use a bread metaphor, which I'm sure all your talks are using bread metaphors, if you think of narrative journalism as, you know, the beautiful French pastry, it's, you know, very delicate and wonderful. It takes, you know, hours of trained work to create this beautiful pastry. On the other hand, you've got blogging, which is the rustic farmer's loaf. It's like got two ingredients, you know, it takes, you know, takes 5 minutes to make, but is good and hearty and has its own value. And I guess my overarching argument today, if you take away one thing from this talk, it's that we are both fighting the Wonder Bread in the middle. We are both attacking the sort of tasteless, overprocessed style that predominates many of our unfortunate dying publications. Just as an aside, do we have anybody from the Poynter Institute here? Hello. Good. Roy. When I was looking at the Wikipedia page, that list of quotes of what people think narrative journalism is, the last one is this. This seems like an ad for the Poynter Institute. Any good writing becomes narrative journalism, according to Poynter. Signed, I'm a skeptic. And according to Wikipedia, that got posted last September, and no one has changed it. And, you know, the idea that Wikipedia is this self-healing organism, that if there's a problem, it gets fixed. So I don't know what that tells you about, you know, trusting online media. But anyway, let's get started. Proposition one. This is my first argument. Oops, this is my first argument. Blogs, like narrative journalism, can be a path to a looser, more human writing style, the kind that readers will connect with and you will enjoy writing. And this keys on that issue I was just talking about, natural storytelling. Now let's start off with this guy. Anybody know who this guy is? He's the guy in the middle here. He's standing between a young Christopher Hitchens and a young Martin Amis. This is James Fenton, and he is probably the preeminent living British poet, which is why no one knows who he is. I've read some of his poetry, and it's, you know, it's good. But I know him mainly through two other things. He is, if you've ever read Redmond O'Hanlon's great book, Into the Heart of Borneo, which is one of the funniest books ever written, he's sort of the co-protagonist of it, so I recommend that to all of you. But also, he has kept on a side career to his poetry as being a journalist. He's sort of been a swashbuckling foreign correspondent over the years. In 1975, he was actually riding on top of the first North Vietnamese tank to break through the gates at the American embassy in Saigon, the fall of Saigon. He was kidnapped by the IRA and held for ransom at one point in the 80s. He was when Ferdinand Marcos was toppled in the coup in 1986, he was in the palace hanging out with Imelda in her shoe closet. So he's, you know, for a poet, he's got a pretty interesting life, is what I'm trying to get across. I read a collection of his work called, of his journalism, called All the Wrong Places some years ago, and there's a passage in the introduction that has stuck with me ever since. It's one of my favorite pieces of writing about journalism. He starts off by writing about the historical origins of what we today call journalism. He calls it reporting in its natural state. Now, what does he mean by this? He mentions the reports that missionaries would send back during the colonial empire days of Europe. You know, if they're in the Congo, they'd write back and say, well, this is what's happening in the Congo. These are the people we've converted. This is what we're seeing. A sort of raw form of reporting that isn't structured like a newspaper story. He mentions the reports that ships, you know, exploring the South Seas would send back to London to say, this is what Polynesia is like. This is what we're discovering. You know, the reports that early newspapers would print from correspondents around the globe when something big and bad would happen. There'd be an earthquake somewhere, and they'd get someone in Lisbon to write a letter saying, this is what happened. This is the natural state of reporting, as he describes it. It doesn't have the conventions of modern journalism. It is just raw human storytelling. I think this is a really important idea. And I think you'd get out a few more contemporary equivalents of this natural storytelling. You know, think of the family tales that get passed down in your family from generation to generation. They very rarely have nut graphs. They very rarely, you know, quote an expert before the jump. You know, they don't follow the conventions, but, you know, we seem somehow to, you know, learn from them just fine. Or the example I like to use when I'm, particularly when I'm talking to new reporters is, think about how you tell, if you go out for a beer with one of your reporter friends at the end of a day of work, what do you tell them? How do you tell them about what you did reporting that day? It's probably going to be a very different sort of conversation than what you just put in the paper. Now, this next passage from this introduction is kind of long, and I'm going to read it, but think about how this applies to your newsroom. Journalism becomes unnatural when it strays too far from such origins, meaning this natural state of reporting. It is quite astonishing to me how much interesting material is jettisoned by newspaper reporters because they know they will not be able to write it up, because to do so would imply they had been present at the events they are describing. And not only present, alive, conscious, and with a point of view. On a trip through the Sub-Sahara, I shared a vehicle with an American reporter who wasn't enjoying himself at all. It was a rough journey, and at one point, alarmingly, we broke down. I remember my companion banging his head against the seat of the car and groaning, we're fucked, you know. Weeks later, I saw what he'd written about the trip and was amused to see that his only personal appearance in his narrative was under the rubric, a Western observer. Under the rules of his newspaper, he was not allowed to say, I saw this, or I did that, or even, at this moment, I really believe we were all finished. But the rules under which he was working were invented decades ago by horrible old men obsessed with the idea of stamping out good writing. And the horrible old men passed on their skills to a series of young men who would never have become horrible without training. And these guys proceeded to attempt to make life as horrible as possible for us. Of the author of any of these American newspaper-style books, one could say, as Blake wrote of Reynolds, this man was hired to depress art. Jesus, I love that passage. And I think, you know, the kind of work that he's talking about is something that is immediately recognizable to everybody in this room. I mean, as I said, it's why you're here, because you realize that is the enemy. That's what we're trying to defeat. You know, we all know how efficient newspapers can be. I'm a newspaper guy, so I'm going to talk a bit from that perspective, but I'm sure this applies to all your media. How efficient newspapers can be at sucking the life out of interesting stories. You know, we all know how often we can't write the most interesting things we hear about because there just isn't a news peg to hang it on. We know how the funniest bits of our stories are often the ones that get shot for space because they don't fit that start-to-end death march of the inverted pyramid, you know? It's precisely because we hate these horrible newspaper conventions that good writers want to use the power of narrative to tell real stories that are reflective of real life. But again, I don't think it takes a 15-part Tom French series to do that. You can do it with rawness instead of polish. You can have the farmer's loaf. That's my theory. Let me tell you a story. In 2005, I was covering a school district, a really bad school district in Dallas, where I work, called Wilmer Hutchins was the name of it. The superintendent had been indicted. The school board, it was about to be tossed out by the state for just being not particularly competent en masse. there were there's new news of corruption every 45 minutes, it seemed, some violation of basic ethics. And they were having all these emergency school board meetings because they were having a lot of emergencies. So, you know, 2-3 nights a week they'd gather, and I'd have to go out and cover these school board meetings. And at the, you know, there's all this crazy stuff going on. There'd be fights, there'd be yelling matches, people would be, you know, bumping chests. It was, you know, quite a dramatic enterprise as school board meetings go. And after those meetings, I'd always go back to the office and I'd file my story. And on the way back home, I'd usually call my girlfriend and just, you know, tell her this is what happened. Oh my God, you never believe, this guy was totally getting in this guy's face, and this guy totally busted out Robert's Rules of Order, and man, it was awesome. And my girlfriend is not a news junkie. She doesn't read the newspaper, is just completely uninterested in all these things, but she would always get interested. She would get involved and engaged in the idea because it was being told in a conversational form. And then the next morning, you know, I'd post on my blog, you know, hey, I had a story in today's paper, and you know, she'd click through, the only time she would ever read the newspaper. And if I'd ask her, so what'd you think of the story? You know, she'd try to be polite, but she'd say, it was a lot more interesting when you were saying it before. And she was right. There was something essential that had been ripped out of that story in that commodification process, that transfer into newspaperese. So I was thinking about this, and I came up with a concept that I fully expect to be enshrined in journalism schools for generations to come. I hope at the Poynter Institute you'll be teaching this soon. So I wanted to give it the best name I possibly could, so I'd like to introduce to you the Benton Curve of Journalistic Interestingness. Now, the Benton Curve has two axes, you know, it's plotted on a chart, and you know, you have time as the x-axis, you have interestingness as the y-axis. So for example, something that is completely uninteresting and happened just now would be in the bottom right-hand corner. You know, if you're doing a story about like the invention of the wheel, like an anniversary piece, I mean, the wheel's pretty interesting, so that'd be way up over there because it's really old as well, the wheel, as well as this slide. Take my school board meeting as an example. You know, right after they happen, they'd be right here. You know, this is the raw state. Now, right after the school board meeting happens, it's really interesting in part because the news is fresh. It just happened, and you know, news grows stale over time, like my bread metaphor. But part of it is also that it hadn't been mangled into newspaper form yet. It's still that raw human communication. What happens, though, is that wonderful bit of interestingness, as time marches on and gets transferred into a 12-inch story with a nut graph and phrases like experts say and could not be reached for comment and to be sure and all those other horrible cliches we put in our stories, as those all sneak in, it gets less interesting. And, you know, the curve goes down. You'll never guess where the curve goes after this. Now here's where narrative journalism often comes in, because sometimes an editor or a reporter will see a glimmer of interestingness in this story, and they'll say something like, why don't you give me a big picture follow for Sunday? What does this all mean, you know? Or they'll say, give me an analysis piece with a second-day lead, you know, something that has real people in it. Or they'll say, you know, write a TikTok, you know, tell us what the scene was like. They're basically asking you, use the tools that you have as a writer to salvage the interestingness of this story. So if everything works out well, then you end up with, as time marches on, that Sunday story, that follow story that we're all going to read about Elliot Spitzer 2 months from now in the New York Times Magazine about his, you know, long career of whoring. That will be really interesting. It'll take a while, but we'll get there. You know, we all know we'll get there. The problem is that not every story makes it that far. A lot of stories get abandoned around the second star. Oh, and I got a little curve, too. I'm just playing around with Keynote. It's a great program. Blogging, you know, puts an emphasis on that left star. It is about capturing observations and reactions and moments at an early stage in the process, when news is both fresh and still unformed, when it still has that nebulous excitement that comes with human communication. It also forces you to ask a different sort of question than the questions we often ask, in newspapers at least. The question we ask in newspapers is it a story? We think of things that define, you know, there are a certain set of standards that have to be met for something to be a story. Whereas in blogging, the question is it interesting? It's a slightly different framing, but it opens up the world of a whole lot of things that don't make it into our newspapers very often, but can make it into a different format. Now, if you excuse a brief, slightly off-topic interlude for a minute, you remember the end of that quote? I told you I love this quote. I'm coming back to it. As Blake wrote of Reynolds, this man was hired to depress art. Now, raise your hand if you know who Blake is. We've got a lot of William Blake fans in the house. Very nice. Do you know, raise your hand if you know who Reynolds is.
Joshua Reynolds.
Excellent first name. Doesn't have much else going for him. So, yes, you're right. William Blake and Joshua Reynolds. I'm very proud of you, sir. It turns out that their careers have a few parallels to our situation, which I hope you'll indulge me in. Reynolds was the best-known painter of his day. He was the embodiment of the establishment. He was the first president of the Royal Academy of the Arts in Britain, and he was a very popular portraitist for all the rich folks because he basically believed that people should be idealized. You'll never see any of his paintings and find some guy who has this ugly mole on his cheek because he got rid of all the moles. Created this very idealized form that he believed was the important thing about painting. He was also known for being boring. Dr. Johnson wrote about him once, Sir Joshua Reynolds possesses the largest share of inoffensiveness of any man that I know. Inoffensiveness, not the strongest endorsement. He thought that the definition of genius was the perfect imitation of everybody who had come before. He's one of these guys who thought that if the Greeks did something, they probably did it as well as it could possibly ever be done. So he would paint people in these sort of stilted positions that no one actually is ever in because he thought, like, that's what Greek sculpture reminded him of. He was dull and conventional, and as you saw from the hands, he's pretty much forgotten. Not too many people think about Joshua Reynolds on a regular basis. As opposed to Blake, who was an unknown in his lifetime, was never famous, didn't hang out with the aristocracy. He was a political radical fighting against the slave trade. You know, he was an advocate for complete racial and sexual equality. He liked mixing and matching forms. He would write poetry to go along with his artwork, which was kind of a new idea at the time. He's remembered as one of the finest British poets of his era, which is probably how most of you know of him. He hated having to follow established convention. I mean, that doesn't look like something that was painted in 1797. He's, you know, modern and primitive at the same time. He had the fantastic, that looks straight off of, you know, some Dungeons and Dragons, you know, player handbook. He did all this weird stuff. And he was actually Reynolds' student at the Royal Academy, and he thought his teacher was an ass. He just thought he was a reactionary buffoon. And when Reynolds, towards the end of his life, published a book of all of his collected writings and his theories about art, Blake bought a copy and spent several years going line by line throughout it, annotating it, and basically saying, that's a bunch of crap, and going on every page, every line, saying, this Reynolds is a fool. And the line, the man was hired to depress art, comes from the title page, because that's right what he wrote right under his name on the title page in his copy. But Blake is remembered today. You know, Dylan and Ginsberg cite him as great influences in poetry, you know, R. Crumb and Maurice Sendak cite his paintings as a real influence on their style. So to sum up, we have Reynolds, we have someone who's hidebound, who believes things should be done the way they've always been done, that we shouldn't offend anybody, that she would make everything seem smooth and rigid even when it's not smooth and rigid. We have Blake, who thinks convention exists to be subverted, who's willing to experiment with new forms, who's willing to cause a little trouble. Which one matches your newsroom? This, again, is another area where I think the narrative people and the bloggers are united in the battle. You know, we don't want our business to be as forgotten as Joshua Reynolds is today. And I think that, you know, that we have to do something about it, and I think blogging can be part of that solution. That's all a bit theory. We're going to talk a little bit more about actual blogging soon, don't worry. Boring, forgotten, influential, remembered. Proposition 2. Blogs, like narrative journalism, can give you a sense of place and time, an in-the-moment feeling that traditional newspaper stories can struggle with. Now, this is something, of course, that good narrative, you know, like a good novel, does very well. Many of you are probably familiar with Enrique's Journey. It always seems to be mentioned 6 times at conferences like this. The great LA Times series about a boy trying to sneak into the United States to reunite with his mother. And when you read that story, you're riding on that train with Enrique. I mean, you're in that moment. You have the sensory perceptions that put you in that place. Let me give you a couple examples about how the rawness of reporting in its natural state and blogging can accomplish something similar. I'll start with something prosaic. I know from looking at the laptops in previous sessions that we have a few Apple fans in the house, such as myself. On the Apple fans calendar, the high holy days are always the days when Steve Jobs, the CEO, gets up on stage and announces, you know, what new product he has, you know, decided we are worthy of and that we will all have to buy sometime soon thereafter. The biggest one of these speeches every year is in January when he gives the keynote address at the Macworld conference in San Francisco. Now, this is an interesting situation because Apple invites the press to this conference, to this talk, and some number of people are allowed to buy tickets to go to this big event where, you know, he unveils the iPhone or whatever it may be. But there are tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe more than that, of Apple fans who would love to be there but can't. You know, it's not like it's simulcast live via video or anything. So they can't experience something they want to experience. So how does that gap get filled? The way it gets filled is that there are dozens of websites, I'll just flip through a few of these, who send bloggers to attend the Macworld keynote and whenever Steve Jobs gets up on a stage. And what they do is they serve as, you know, the Virgil leading Dante through hell. They're the guide who tells the reader, this is how it feels to be right here in this moment. Every sentence that Steve Jobs says gets transcribed and commented on all these sites. There are dozens of these folks who do this at the same time. And in real time, Apple fans all around the world open up all these websites in their browsers, hit reload every 30 seconds, and just so they can see moment by moment what is happening. Now, these tech blogs, they're good narrative journalists in a way. They do a pretty good job of evoking the scene. Now, for example, here are some of the things that they were writing right before the keynote started. You know, the color scheme for the usher's clothing, you know, a nice soothing shade of eggshell blue. They're discussing the soundtrack, what is playing, you know. That's interesting, no, not Coldplay this time. That's kind of interesting, it's more of a New Order kind of theme, you know, bomb sniffing dogs, the lights are dimming, or Scott is having some sort of stroke. You know, is there at least 200 people here setting up to live blog? Once the speech begins, they're giving a moment by moment analysis. They're saying, oh my God, he's looking at the bottom of the laptop now. I mean, how prosaic is that? You know? Or, you know, instant reaction like, holy crap, that's thin. This January, they introduced a very thin new laptop. Or when Steve, instead of saying boom when demoing a new figure, he said zoom one time. And all these blogs thought that was worthy of note, and they would type that into their scene. I particularly like one guy who wanted to illustrate how Apple's stock was down during the talk, but instead he wrote Apple sock is down 4.5%, which is, you know, get some better elastic, I guess. The tale of the crowd's reaction, you know, crowd didn't like the price, you know, stoked, dude. And then at the end of this particular one in January, Randy Newman, I mean, how strange is that? Randy Newman came out on stage and sang some songs. And, you know, they're saying, Randy Newman is coming across a bit like your crazy drunk old uncle. Now, here's where I should, in the interest of disclosure, admit something to you. In January, I was in Morocco on a reporting trip in Oujda, whose official city nickname is the City of Fear. That's good PR. I was in Oujda, which is right on the Algerian border, and at the end of a day of reporting, I will have to admit, I went to an internet cafe, and for an hour and a half, I hit reload in Firefox with 10 tabs up of all these websites, because I'm a big freak. But what's interesting about this phenomenon, though, and this happens every time again Steve Jobs gets up on a stage, is that literally within seconds of the keynote's conclusion, nobody cares. As soon as it is over, you know, The Wire is sending out stories about all the stuff he announced. All these tech websites will have traditional news stories saying, this is what happened, these are the new products that were announced, you know, these are the new things, you have. This is the new Jesus phone and whatever else. But while the keynote is going on, these guys are getting millions of hits, like server crashing quantities of hits. You know, one of the reasons why it's traditional in this sort of phenomenon to have 10 browser windows up is because three of them are probably going to crash under the load of everyone hitting reload over and over again. Now, why would people do this? Are they going through all this, and are they going to these websites because they want to get the news? I mean, if they want to get the news, there's a much more efficient way to do it. Wait 20 minutes, and there will be stories saying everything that you would want to know. But the reason that they go to these websites and the reason they hit reload is because they are craving the experience of being there. it is an experiential process. They're getting something out of it that goes beyond learning what new products Apple is introducing. They have a feeling that they are there. That's the reason why they want to know what color the ushers' uniforms are and what was the song playing. They want to feel like they're in that moment, in the same way that when you read Enrique's journey, you are in that moment and you think you are on top of that train going across Mexico. No, they're not going to get that sensation from a 10-inch wire story the next day. And the next day, traditionally, Apple will post the video of the entire event online. And, you know, everyone will go and watch it again just to, you know, get back in the moment. But that's not enough. They need to be there at the moment it's happening. Now, this is something that our colleagues in TV already know. You know, that's why they show car chases, you know? Now, if you're anything like me, I don't know how many of you work in newsrooms, but if you, whenever there's a car chase that is shown live on Dallas television, the first reaction from all the people is, oh my God, look at these idiots showing a car chase. Boy, I'm glad I don't work in TV. What a bunch of idiots. And the second reaction is that the entire newsroom stands around the TV set for the next half hour watching the car chase. Because they want that experience. You know, people in newsrooms are more news junkie-ish than most people, but they crave that experience. And that is something that, you know, they want to be on the left side of the bitten curve of journalistic interestingness. They want to get in at that early point. And that's something that blogs can do, that newspaper stories and other media can't do as well. Now, obviously, most people don't care all that much about Apple, you know, not as much as I do, or other people do, but there's probably something they do care about that you could use this for. There are people who care enough about the New England Patriots that they would love to get something like that at every practice. There are people who care enough about whenever there's a controversial issue up at city council who would love to get a minute by minute, so-and-so is up talking now, he's saying this, the crowd's booing, you know, lobbyists is standing in the back, you know, shuffling through his money for bribing people and whatever else. You know, in almost every day in a city, there's going to be something that fits this criteria that is fascinating and experiential for somebody that you could probably do something with. Let me give you another example. In Texas, this man, Tom Craddock, is the Speaker of the House in the state legislature. He is a very powerful man. But not very well liked, quite frankly. And he's more feared than he is liked. And one night in last May, his opponents, Democrats in the House, because he's a Republican, tried to launch a coup against him. They tried to use some parliamentary procedure to oust him from his job. And the place I was watching it, because again, I'm a big dork, I was watching this live streaming video from the House floor at my home, which I got, none of you probably ever want to talk to me again. The place got really tense. It was a crazy scene. People were yelling and screaming. You know, it was kind of cool from my perspective. It reminded me a bit of, you know, that those videos you see at the end of, you know, the local news of like people, like parliament, the Taiwanese parliament, and people start breaking out into a fight or something. That always seems to happen in Taiwan. But anyway, this is exactly the kind of story that you could imagine being boring as hell in your newspaper the next day, because it's about parliamentary procedure. And what in the world is more boring than parliamentary procedure? Now, the story that my paper, the Dallas Morning News, ran the next day wasn't a bad story. It was a perfectly fine story. I'm not here to criticize it. But it did not communicate the energy of the night. But the same people, you know, traditional newspaper stories aren't designed to communicate that energy. That's not what they're there for. But our legislative reporters in Austin have a blog, and they were blogging all night long. And they were posting much juicier stuff on the blog than ever got into the story, you know. Is the House dissolving before our eyes? Suffice it to say, tensions are high. They're saying, you know, security is being beefed up. It's growing ugly. You know, the long simmering House has erupted. Wow, Vesuvian. You know, stunned silence after Craddock does something. At another point, he says, the House went wild. They're screaming. There's yelling. We're approaching meltdown. We're now tangled in points of order. Now, these blog posts are not brilliant prose. This is not going to win a Pulitzer or whatever the online equivalent of a Pulitzer will be at some point. But they do have a tone that you can't get into a newspaper story on most of our publications and with most of our copy desks. They show what James Fenton was talking about in the passage earlier. They show that the writer was actually there watching and listening and engaged and observing. At one point, Craddock decided to have, he was freaked out. This is a guy who's been in the State House for 40 years And he was completely freaked out because he wasn't expecting this coming. So he was afraid he was going to do something wrong and allow some parliamentary procedure to oust him. So he had the parliamentary guru, his buddy, come sit next to him. And for a couple of hours, whenever anyone would ask him a question, and you know, they'd ask Craddock a question, he would not respond. The guy next to him, he would look straight ahead, the guy next to him would say something, and Craddock would lean into the microphone and repeat exactly what he said. And sometimes he would get a word wrong, and the guy would correct him. And sometimes he'd get lost mid-sentence and say, can you say that again? It was a really weird situation, because this guy was clearly freaking out. And, you know, this was a tale that didn't make it into the newspaper the next day. But, you know, they could put it on the blog. They could talk about Craddock the Puppet and Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. Or Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, more accurately, with the question mark. This is the kind of, those lines, Craddock the Puppet and Bergen McCarthy, are lines that I'm willing to bet most copy desks at major metropolitan newspapers would kill if someone tried to sneak it into a story. They would view it as editorializing. Because in my opinion, many American copy desks don't understand the difference between editorializing and observing. And I think that blogs are a really good way to get these sorts of details out there. The blog that night was 1,000 times more interesting than the story the next day. And that is a phenomenon that happens over and over again. You know, these very talented reporters, these guys, you know, they know the Capitol, they know what's going on. They were allowed to use their intelligence, they were allowed to use their knowledge and perspective in a way that, you know, they're not allowed to do when they're writing for Page One. You know, at one point during all this, you know, when someone did something really stupid, one of the reporters wrote, for crying out loud. And it was really stupid what this person did, but, you know, imagine trying to get that into the paper. Of course, that's just impossible.